You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
A number of years ago, different church, different city, a man in his mid to late 40s came into my office to ask me a question. And he began by telling me that he had recently become a Christian. He had made some mistakes in his life, but he was beginning to experience God's grace toward him. And so I said, well, tell me about the mistakes. The latest one was that he had cheated on his wife. He had moved out of the house, abandoned her, and for a period of time was living with the other woman. But that wasn't really what he came to talk about. He shared all that with me freely, but then he said, but here's my question. I'm wondering, now that I'm a Christian, what kind of woman should I be looking for in a wife? And without even hesitating, I replied, well, if I understand things correctly, I think the woman you should be looking for is the wife that you already have. You have a wife, right? And he's like, well, I mean, technically, yeah. I said, okay, well, then your first move is to go to her, to get down on your knees and to beg her for mercy. I don't know why she would take you back. I don't know why she would forgive you, but that's your first move. Ask her to forgive you. Now, nothing in me expected this guy to do that. It's a tough situation. He felt like God had forgiven him, but he did not feel like going and asking her to forgive him. He wanted to move on, you know, clean slate, fresh start, that sort of thing. Put yourself in his shoes. Would you want to ask her for forgiveness? It doesn't even have to be something that severe, dramatic, I suppose. Let's just say that you have gossiped about someone, slandered someone, stole something from someone, lied to someone, manipulated someone, something along those lines. And let's say you've come to the place where you have, like, admitted that to God, asked him for forgiveness. How are you, though, with going to that person and asking them for forgiveness? Even if he did go to her and ask her for forgiveness, would you expect her, after what he had done, to really forgive him? Would you forgive him? Again, let's just make it something less dramatic. Say you've been gossiped about or slandered or manipulated or lied about or stolen from or something like that. How are you in those situations with genuinely forgiving people who've done those things to you? C.S. Lewis said, "Everyone thinks forgiveness is a lovely idea until he has something to forgive." We are working our way through the book of Colossians, and today we're come to chapter 3, verse 13, and we're just going to spend some time in this one verse about forgiveness, because if we included other verses, we would be likely to assume we know what it means, or maybe to try to avoid what it means, and so we're just going to sit in this one little guy. Last week, we looked at verse 12, which is about putting on the character of Christ: compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. This is who Jesus is, and you see it all the time as you read about his life. But as you get to the end of verse 12, or maybe at the end of last week's sermon, you have the question, okay, I have to put on the character of Christ, but how do I know if I'm doing that? Like, how do I know if I'm growing in Christ-like character? And one answer is in verse 13. This isn't everything you could say about that, but it is a very acute, helpful, practical litmus test of whether or not we're growing in Christ-like character. Let's read those verses together. Let's start in verse 12, chapter 3, verse 12. "Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience." Now here's the litmus test: "bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive." When you think about what the church is, you begin to see why forbearing and forgiving are so critical, so essential to life among God's people. The church is a place where you come to be in meaningful relationships with other people that you didn't get to choose. And so by the very nature of it, those people who at first you inevitably always think are great, eventually will begin to get on your nerves. Sometimes they'll bother you and annoy you. Sometimes they'll sin against you. And so the church, just by nature, is a place where there's going to be friction and there's going to be brokenness in relationships. And a sign that the gospel is doing its work in us is that in those relationships, we bear with one another and we forgive one another. Our tendency is to go into one of two directions. Our tendency is to sort of sweep things under the rug and maintain some kind of false peace among the community. Or our tendency is just to run, you know, get out of our small group, avoid that person, leave the church, whatever it is. And Paul is saying, no, that's not the answer. That's not the gospel. The gospel is that God moves toward us while we're sinners. Christ died for the ungodly. And the gospel in Christian community is that we move toward one another in the same way. We work to preserve the unity that we've been given in Christ. And at the heart of that work is bearing with and forgiving each other. I want to spend most of our time talking about forgiveness. We'll get to the bearing with in just sort of an aside. But here's what I want you to see. This is the big idea. Forgiven people forgive. If you've been forgiven, your disposition toward others is to forgive. And so I just want to ask and answer three simple questions, which are, what is forgiveness? Why must we forgive? And how do we forgive? What is forgiveness? Forgiveness obviously is not exclusive to the Bible. All kinds of people talk about and experience the need to forgive and be forgiven. And so whether it's on daytime television or pop psychology or just in your everyday conversations, all kinds of people have thoughts about what forgiveness is. And some of those thoughts, I think, have muddied the water even in Christian circles about what forgiveness is. And so I think the first thing we need to do is just kind of get on the same page. What is biblical forgiveness? And as you look throughout the scriptures, two really big ideas come to the surface related to forgiveness, and they're these. Forgiveness involves canceling debt and absorbing loss or pain. You could say suffering, right? Forgiveness always involves canceling a debt and absorbing the loss. Let's talk about canceling debt. One time, Peter asked Jesus how many times he would have to forgive somebody who kept sinning against him. And he threw a number out. He's like seven? Is seven good? Jesus is like, it's a good start, but I was thinking like 70 times seven, which means just as many times as you have to. And as Jesus usually does, because he wants to get you to think, he actually develops that answer to Peter in the form of a parable. And in that parable, he uses the image of debts to describe sins, like monetary debts. And in that parable, therefore, forgiveness is viewed as a forgiven or canceled debt. Let me just read this little parable to you because we may come back to it. He says to Peter, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that they had, and payment to be made. And so the servant fell on his knees, imploring him. He said, 'Have patience with me. I will pay you everything.' And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt." So forgiveness is a canceling of debt. And the first thing I want you to see is that when Jesus talks about debt and forgiveness, debt is connected to sin. Forgiveness is related to sin, not annoyances, which is actually a really important distinction. It's a distinction that Paul makes in Colossians 3. By distinguishing bearing with one another and forgiving each other, Paul is trying to give us a full view of just how we do life together. The word for forbearing or bearing with is different than forgiving. It literally means to endure. Paul is saying you got to endure people. You got to put up with people. It has the idea of putting up with each other's differences and, you know, their little awkward things and their oddities, their preferences and personalities, that kind of stuff. People are annoying, right? And the reason they're annoying is because they're not like us, which means you're annoying to someone else because you're not like them. This is what we all bring to the table. Welcome to church. We're annoying. Not every issue is a forgiveness issue. The fact that I'm bothered or feel offended or that my feelings have been hurt does not necessarily mean that I've been sinned against. It might mean that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. It might just be that I'm insecure about something. It might be that I have read something into the situation that isn't there. I've assumed motives on the other person's part. I've jumped to conclusions. It might just be that it's difficult for me to get along with that person. I don't understand them in some way. It could be lots of things. And what is needed in those situations may not be forgiveness. It might just be forbearance, putting up with, enduring. And that doesn't mean I ignore them. That's not the imagery. The imagery carries with it this idea of holding up, of supporting each other, and being willing to sacrifice even for their good. It means moving toward one another with compassionate hearts and kindness and humility and meekness and patience. Jesus was forbearing. Just the fact of his incarnation and his perfection means he had to put up with people, and he did. He put up with them. He held them up. He literally sacrificed for their good. So most of the day-to-day Christian community stuff, I think, kind of falls in this category. We need to bear with one another. But as we're bearing with one another, as we're enduring together, inevitably we will sin against each other because, you know, we're sinners. And when we do that, we need more than just bearing with. We need to forgive one another. And again, that has the idea of canceling debt. When someone wrongs you, you automatically feel like they owe you something, right? When my kids disobey me, which never happens, but when it does, just hypothetically speaking, like this morning, I feel like I've lost something, like I've lost respect, and I want them to pay. I feel like they owe me some respect, and I don't know how I would exact that payment, but I'm going to try. I'm going to try to exact it maybe by yelling, or maybe by like punishing them in some way, or making them feel bad, or reminding them of all the other times that they've done this. I'm going to exact payment somehow because I feel like they owe me. Everybody feels this. We want people to pay, and sheer justice would give us that right. Forgiveness is simply letting go of that right to exact payment by canceling the debt. This has very practical implications. It means when you cancel a debt to someone, it means you don't hold it over them. You don't pull it out when you need leverage in the relationship or when you're angry at them. It means you don't avoid them or give them the cold shoulder. You don't gossip or slander about them and then sort of justify it in your mind because of what they did. They deserve it. You don't cultivate ill will toward them, right? You don't replay the tapes in your mind of what they did so that you would cultivate a bitterness toward them. You don't root for them to fail or rejoice when they do. These are all ways that we try to exact payment from those who have wronged us. And by canceling the debt, we're saying we refuse to play those games. We've suffered a loss. We want people to suffer in some way. That's why we try to exact payment. And that gets to the second sort of idea in what forgiveness is. The first one's canceling debt. The second one is absorbing the loss or suffering. When someone sins against someone, there's always a debt, and it always has to be paid, right? So forgiveness doesn't make the debt disappear. If you owe me $100 and I forgive that debt, it doesn't just vanish. Somebody pays, right? So if I make you pay me, then you suffer the loss of your $100. But if I cancel the debt, well, then I suffer the loss of the $100. But in any case, someone pays the debt. Someone absorbs the loss. There will always be suffering where there is forgiveness. This is why Tim Keller says that forgiveness is a form of voluntary suffering. When we're talking about money, it's kind of easy to get your mind around. But you can lose lots of things besides money, right? When someone sins against you, you can lose reputation. You can lose happiness. You can lose a sense of peace of mind. You can lose opportunities. You can lose all kinds of things. And in those cases, you can return harm for harm, right? Make them suffer as you have suffered. Or you can absorb the loss. You can voluntarily suffer in order to forgive. Now, I need to sort of make a little aside here because I think this is where the waters get muddied. I think when we hear the idea of absorbing the loss, of voluntarily suffering, it gives you this picture that we're to be sort of a doormat for people's sin. And that's not the case. That's not what Jesus or Paul says about forgiveness. I think we think that because of this popular phrase in our culture, forgive and forget. That's not in the Bible, and I don't think it's biblical either. I don't think forgiveness means forgive and forget. It doesn't mean that you have to forget what's been done to you or that you have to stop feeling the pain in some way. It doesn't mean that you can't talk about it after you've forgiven someone. You know how this goes? You forgive somebody and they accept it, but then you still have questions, you want to sort it out, you want to process, and so you bring it up again. And they're like, oh, well, then you haven't forgiven me because you're always bringing it up again. I've done this. I've been the offending party in this situation where I've asked forgiveness and gotten it, and then someone, my wife, wants to talk about it. And I'm like, well, I thought you forgave me. And she's like, yeah, I did, but I still want to understand. I want to talk about it. As I reflect on those situations, I can see in hindsight that in that moment, I'm not genuinely interested in her happiness. It's not that I'm upset that she's still sad or angry. I'm interested in her happiness, not for her sake, but for my sake. I want to move on. I want to feel better about myself. And when she feels sad or confused or angry about it, I don't feel better about myself. So don't manipulate people by telling them that they've got to forget if they've forgiven you. That's not what it means. When you forgive someone, you're making a commitment not to hold their sin over them. It doesn't mean that you totally forget about it. Of course you remember. Some situations will come up. The emotions even will arise. Forgiveness just simply means that in those moments, you're going to refresh your commitment to forgive. You're not going to entertain, replay the tapes, and cultivate bitterness toward the person. Forgiveness doesn't mean that you don't have to establish some boundaries, perhaps, in a relationship, especially where someone continually offends and sins against you. You might need to build some boundaries into that relationship. You might need to bring some other people into it. That doesn't mean you haven't forgiven them. That just means you're being wise. All right, so that's my little aside. Forgiveness is absorbing the loss, which doesn't mean being a doormat, but it means voluntarily suffering and not requiring that they suffer as you've suffered. My friend, he did go back. He went to her. He did exactly what I said. He got on his knees. He begged for mercy. He asked her forgiveness. And when he went back to her, this was the choice that she had to make. Would she cancel the debt or would she hold it over him? Would she use it against him? Would she absorb the loss? You know, she's feeling betrayal. She's feeling all kinds of pain. She's feeling embarrassed. And what would she do with all of that pain? Would she make him feel it too, or would she absorb the loss? That's the choice that she had to make. And to his surprise, and to mine, to be honest, she forgave him. She canceled the debt. She absorbed the loss. She said, I forgive you. He moved back in. They're still together. It's a wonderful story. But let me say this. That wasn't the end of the story. That was just the beginning of the story, made possible by that initial act of forgiveness. Forgiveness is hardly ever just a one-time thing. It begins somewhere. It begins by that decision to cancel the debt and absorb the loss. But it has to continually be refreshed. You know how many times, how many evenings they were in our living room rehashing it, trying to refresh their commitment to forgive and be forgiven? That's how it works. It has to begin somewhere. So forgiveness is canceling debt and absorbing the loss. And that is hard to do. Emotionally, physically, psychologically, spiritually, real forgiveness like that is hard to do. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. In fact, we must do it. This isn't like one of those things that Paul's like, this would be a good idea. This is one of those things that's like, you have to do this, and I want you to see how strong the language is. Paul says we forgive as the Lord has forgiven us, or because the Lord has forgiven us. And so I want you to just come back to what that means. Flip over to Colossians 2, verse 13 and 14. We must forgive because God has forgiven us. God has canceled the debt against us and absorbed the loss. Look at what he says in Colossians 2, verse 13. It says, you were dead in your trespasses. Trespasses mean sins or debts is another translation. You were dead in them. You could not pay. It wasn't like you just needed to make a run to the bank and you'd be back. You could not pay. They rendered you helpless, dead. And in the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him. So you who were dead, God made alive together with Christ. How did he do this? Well, having forgiven all our debts. Well, how did he do that? By canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. So the law of God is the righteous character of God on display. It describes what humanity is meant to be, what you and I are supposed to be. But at every point in the law, we absolutely fall short. You can summarize the law by saying loving God with everything that you have and loving each other as yourself. And we confess that, rightly so today, that we have not loved our neighbor as ourselves. We fall short at every point. And so that law, which we have not fulfilled, stands against us as a record of debts. It's a legal demand that we can't fulfill. And look what Paul says. He says, God has taken that record of debt that stood against you. This he set aside, where? Nailing it to the cross. What was nailed to the cross? Jesus. The way that God cancels the debt against you is to absorb the loss in himself, to be nailed to the cross, to voluntarily suffer on your behalf the suffering that you deserve, so that you can be made right with God. We forgive because the Lord has forgiven us. There just isn't a category in Scripture for a Christian, one who has been forgiven like that, to not then offer forgiveness to others. It would just be the utmost hypocrisy. Jesus actually says that pretty plainly. When he teaches the disciples to pray, one of those lines in there is, forgive our debts as we forgive our debtors. They're meant to go together. And then just to make sure you've got it, after that prayer, he gives a little commentary just on that verse. This is what he says. If you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you. That's pretty strong. Surely he means something else. No, that's exactly what he means. These are meant to go together so that you can see forgiven people forgive. That's where the parable goes. You know, the guy that begged for mercy and then the master forgave his debt. As the parable continues, he goes out free, happy, finds a guy that owes him some money. And he's like, give me my money. And the guy does what he did. He begged for mercy. And the guy who had been forgiven had no mercy. And when other people found out about it, they went to the master and they said, hey, this guy who you forgave his debt, he's not forgiving the debt of others. And you know what the master calls him? Wicked. Wicked. Because there is no category for forgiven people that don't forgive. Forgiven people forgive. So we forgive because the Lord has forgiven us, and we forgive as the Lord has forgiven us. That's how we forgive. So how has God forgiven us? Well, he took the initiative. He offered forgiveness. We've kind of talked about those things. Canceled the debt. He absorbed the pain. Let me add one more thing to the equation. When God offers forgiveness, it's always for the purpose of reconciliation. God's not just up in the sky making sort of like spiritual transactions where he's canceling debts impersonally. It's always so that we might be restored to relationship, that we might be reconciled. And so what does that mean for us in how we forgive one another? Well, it means first, we take the initiative. So in Matthew 5, Jesus says, if you're at the altar, giving your gifts, and there you remember someone else has something against you. All right, so you sin against them, but you remember they're giving you the cold shoulder. Something's not right there. They're acting funny. You remember that. He says, what you do in that moment is you go. You leave your gifts at the altar, and you go and be reconciled to that person, and then you come back to church. In Matthew 18, before the parable that we read, actually, it says that if you know that you sinned against someone, you go and make it right. You be reconciled with them. And so in either case, whether I'm the offending party or the one offended or sinned against, Jesus seems to say that the ball is always in my court, so to speak. God always puts the responsibility of initiative on you. Well, what if you sin against each other? Whose job is it for initiative? Both. Right? That's what it means to be forgiven. It means I am free not to dig my heels in, not to demand that they come to me, but to move toward people with grace and mercy and truth. So we take the initiative. And we forgive. In Mark 11, Jesus says this. When you stand praying, notice it's when you're at church, it's when you're praying, that's when these things come to mind. And so there's a connection here. If you don't have disciplines of like being in the Word and praying and being in community, being at church, you may have all kinds of messed up relationships that never come to mind. This is kind of where stuff comes to mind for some reason. So when you're praying, if you hold anything against anyone, forgive him. And so here the timing is a little different. He's saying that right there, as you're praying, as you're standing there, forgive that person. Right? So they're not even there. You don't even know how they're going to respond. You don't know what they're going to say or do, if they're going to be defensive or repentant. It doesn't matter. In that moment, decide in your heart that you're not going to hold his sin over him. You're going to cancel the debt and you're going to absorb the pain. And then after that, that you're going to move toward him or her for reconciliation. Forgiveness is relational. It always has the trajectory of restoring relationship. Chris Bronze, in his book, Unpacking Forgiveness, says this. Forgiveness is a figurative handshake. You can't shake hands alone. For forgiveness to happen, you need to seek out the offending party, or the offended party if you're the offender. Extend your hand and pray that the other party will offer his or hers to you. And in Matthew 5 and in Matthew 18, we see this is always the goal. The goal is always reconciliation. Canceling the debt, absorbing the pain, not as the end of the story, but as a means to reconcile with one another. We have been called into one body. We're going to annoy each other. We're going to sin against each other. And what it means to pursue unity, to maintain the unity that we've been given, is to bear with and to forgive. I have seen too much in this community. People be hurt, people be sinned against, and just, you know, sort of process it internally. Just decide in their mind that they forgive them. And I think what's actually happening there is we're deciding we're just going to try not to be angry at that person anymore. We're not moving toward people. We're not extending the hand of forgiveness, praying that they would extend their hand too. We're not speaking grace and truth in those moments. So if you deal with all of your conflict internally, you know, you forgave them in your spirit, I just don't think that's the full picture of what Paul's talking about. I think Paul's talking about people who are reconciled. Christian community requires it. We have to forgive as the Lord forgives, and that always involves moving toward people. I've shared this story before a couple years ago, I think, but it's so powerful, and I think it brings together all the things that we've talked about, so I'm going to share it again. This is from Radiolab, if you've ever listened to that show, and it's the story of Hector Black. Hector and his wife moved to Atlanta in the mid-60s to be a part of the civil rights movement. They kind of lived in a rough part of town. Kids would come over to their house and play all the time. Kids who, some were homeless, some were just in difficult home situations. One of those little girls was named Patricia. And Patricia would come all the time. Sometimes they would be homeless and she would sleep at their house. And when Hector and his wife, when it came time for them to move, Patricia asked if she could move with them. And so they made arrangements and took her in as their daughter. and she flourished. She blossomed. She went on to get several degrees and actually began to work with kids who had similar situations that she had had growing up. Well, let me fast forward a bit. One night when Patricia was 43, she was gone. A crack addict had been roaming around her street, saw that her lights are out, came in. She wasn't there. He stole some money, went out, bought some drugs. Was walking back by her house later that night. Lights were still off, so he goes, but this time she's there. She hears something. He's in the house and she comes home. He hears her. And so he just goes in the closet to hide because he's just thinking, I'm going to wait for a time to get out of here. He doesn't want any trouble. But she comes into the closet and he freaks out and pushes her over, ties her up. They have this weird conversation where she like offers him food and he tells her how to install burglary bars on her windows. I mean, it's just odd. He leaves. He does a lot of drugs. He's high as a kite. He goes back to the house a third time. This time, I'll spare you the details, he violates and murders Patricia. Now, here's the rest of the story in Hector's words, Patricia's dad. He said, when we learned about this, it was the darkest thing that had ever happened to our family. We had known death, but not like this. My first reaction was that he was a monster and that he deserved no compassion from me. Little by little, I learned about his life. I learned about this guy's childhood. It was awful in every respect. Hector says, it wasn't that I was trying to excuse what he had done, but I felt for him as another human being suffering. There was a hearing in Atlanta. It was the final hearing in the case. And after this man, Ivan Simpson was his name, after he was sentenced to life with no possibility of parole, they gave all those that knew Patricia a chance to come up and talk to Ivan. When it was my turn, Hector said, I had printed out a statement because I didn't know how steady my words would be. I said how much we loved Patricia. At the end, I said, I don't hate you, Ivan Simpson, but I hate with all my soul what you did to my daughter. Then the very last thing I had to say, I turned around and faced him. And when I said my last, I wished for all of us who had been so wounded by this crime that we might find God's peace. And I wish this for you, Ivan Simpson. And Hector describes the scene. He says, our eyes met. Tears were streaming down his cheeks. I'll never forget the look. It was like a soul in hell. He asked to come to the microphone, and twice he said through his tears, I'm so sorry for the pain I've caused. Hector says, that night I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about this. He had given me the only thing he had. He asked me to forgive him in those words. And I knew that I had forgiven him. Now, in our culture, that's usually where the story stops. Somebody commits an atrocious thing and people say, I forgive you. But in Hector's story, that's where the story really begins. Hector started writing Ivan in prison, and Ivan would write back. One of the things that Ivan said is that he missed God's touch. Ever since he had killed Patricia, he felt as though God's hand had abandoned him. But he felt that he had heard God's voice by way of compassion and what Hector had said in the courtroom. They wrote dozens of letters back and forth. At one point, Hector and his wife sent him a Christmas package. And Hector thought, oh my gosh, what are we doing? We're sending the man who murdered our daughter Christmas presents. But he said, I knew I had to do it because when you forgive someone, you start to care about them again. Hector and Ivan were becoming friends. He wraps it up by saying, my wife and I went to visit Ivan in prison. I think what happened there was that we were sitting down and talking together for a few hours and we were very close. It was extraordinary. And when it was time to leave, we stood up. And because we were so close, it seemed the most natural thing just to embrace each other in our arms. It was an unbelievable moment that I could have my arms around the man who murdered my daughter. And then he says, I think forgiveness is possible for the worst. And we all need forgiveness. Can you imagine the joy that Ivan Simpson has standing in Hector's arms? The relief, the peace. That's us. We're not Hector in this story. We're Ivan. And God has moved toward us. He has not only extended the handshake of forgiveness, he has taken us into his arms. We are reconciled. We're friends with God. And because of that, we must and we can move toward others in the same way. You can extend the handshake of forgiveness to people in this room. You can do it today. And you can pray that that leads to an embrace of reconciliation. Because by God's grace, it can. Let's pray toward that end.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.